Welcome one and all to another episode of Left Turn Canada. Andy Burkowski, Crisco Avalese here, the podcast where we look at all of the issues that are affecting Canadians from that leftist perspective that's often missing. Over the last several shows, we've been talking about this growing crisis that I think is obviously, again, on everyone's mind, but the pandemic and how Ontarians are dealing with it, how the Ontario government is dealing with it. And Christo, I did notice one really big sea change that I haven't seen since the pandemic really started in earnest. You know, for I think close to 500 days, I've been getting emails from various news outlets every day telling me how many new cases they are. It was kind of that real broad stroke of how the province and the country in general are doing. This week was the very first time when that information shifted now into how many people are joining the ICU based on their infection of COVID. There's still some indicators. They'll say like, oh, maybe it's 10,000, maybe it's 9,000, but there's an acknowledgement from general news sources that the province and perhaps even the greater country just doesn't have the ability to monitor the cases that are new cases that are coming up. And frankly, in many cases here in Ontario, kind of doesn't even want to know. We talked about this last week, didn't we? Like there's a big push to not even do the amount of testing to ensure that we know exactly how many people in, you know, your local communities, your local schools. And that was the big issue last week that I believe will still continue. There's no message of that changing. But yeah, we're definitely reaching a new phase in this pandemic here in the province and in Canada. And it's a scary thing because now we're facing it without the protections, as limited as they were, of CERB to ensure that we, you know, we had those additional protections. People that were on CERB likely already used up all their EI. And, you know, I think it's important to say that most of the crises that we're facing now are things that were monitored and warned to us by experts over the past 10 years. You know, the amount of access of the healthcare sector and how that's been shrinking over the past 10 years is leading us to this big crisis. Whereas before, the narrative was, and it's still a big issue of people that decide not to get vaccinated for various reasons and how that's affecting things. I think now it's pretty safe to say that the cracks in our system and a lot of the current deaths that we're going to see are because of us not supporting a system that has been failing here in the province, at the very least, over the last 10 years. You know, just access to the amount of people versus the amount of hospital beds. I think it's like down 50% from 2007. I know Nora was pushing a lot of those stats this week. And it's a change that I'm wondering if you're feeling as much. The shift in narrative and, Christo, I guess also the shift in tone of how the powers that be are talking about the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely noticed that they're de-emphasizing cases. Mm-hmm. There's been a debate about this. Some people suggest that is probably correct because cases one-to-one are not as severe as they used to be. And so the correlation between cases and the other numbers are not as direct as they used to be. I'm not necessarily sure I agree, but that is an argument some people have made. Mm-hmm. That cases are significantly higher than they used to be, but people don't understand that one, you know, Omicron case does not necessarily equal one Delta case.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the reason. I think honestly, and to underline that, the reason they emphasize hospitalizations and ICU in particular is that, you know, that's a finite resource, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, in a very practical matter, if the ICUs are full, then whether it's more COVID patients or whether it's other people that have non-COVID health emergencies, they may not be able to get the care they need. And I think that's the emphasis. And even in some cases where ICUs were not as full, even just regular hospital beds being occupied limits the capacity of the hospital to take care of, you know, moderate health needs that aren't directly related to COVID, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think the biggest factor is just like the testing infrastructure has fallen apart.
Yeah.
I mean, in certain areas where there were high levels of cases, it was hard to get tests. Kingston, I know that before this wave, getting a test was relatively easy. You could book one, you could usually get it within 24 hours, and you could usually get the results within 24 hours. In some cases, you would be looking at 24 hours between booking your test to getting the result, right? Like if you booked at the right time and you got lucky and all that. You know, we've had to get my son tested for COVID before, to for daycare. But once Omicron hit, and, you know, there communities that were getting, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 cases a day were now getting 300-400 cases a day, the testing infrastructure isn't there. Yeah. And so I think it's just a practical reality is that, one, the news, if they actually want to be accurate, they sort of have to de-emphasize testing, not even from a philosophical standpoint, but, like, how can they be sure?
Yeah.
Like, how can you fucking know, right? Like, you can say to yourself, okay, we got this many confirmed cases, and that's fine, I guess. And you're providing the information that you have. But we all know, everyone knows, that the number is being severely... It was always undercounted, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
It was always undercounted. Even back at the beginning, yeah.
Now it's, but it's a different story.
Because even people that, you know, believe in... treating this seriously and get tested when they have symptoms and do all of the work. You know, those people would always get tested before. Now, many of them aren't able to get tested. They're just told to assume they have COVID and do the insufficient amount of isolation that's often being recommended. And so, yeah, if you're asking people like or telling people, look, we have like 5,000 cases in this province today. Then it's like, no, there's way more than that. There's gotta be way more than that. And you can never know for sure, you can know even less than before. And so I guess from a pure practical standpoint, in general, we would have a good idea of hospitalizations. Those are all tracked by the hospitals and the regional health authorities. So we'll know who goes to the hospital because of COVID, who gets to the ICU, who passes away because of COVID. Those numbers are not going to change because if you have a, you know, mild COVID case, you're not going to be in the hospital or the ICU, or you're not going to pass away. And so in general, those numbers are likely far more accurate, although they're probably still undercounted as well. People are dying of COVID, but it's not everyone is going to necessarily be classified as such. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And I think that change is bringing out really interesting tendencies from the entire spectrum of people. When I worked in Toronto in radio for many years, I worked the overnights, and normally when you had to get police info, you were, you know, following the scanners and eventually following the Twitter for the scanners. And something happened this week in Toronto that in my many years working overnights, I never saw, where they outwardly said, you know, code red, we don't have any more ambulances available. And that was something I hadn't seen. And this was even during, you know, when there were shootings and other calamities that were happening in the city of Toronto. That didn't happen. So the idea that resources are being pushed to the limit, I think, is very real and will have that impact. Like, it's been categorized. We've seen it, how people have died, not from COVID, but of lack of access to medical services that they need to survive. The issue is that when different people are faced with that fact, we're seeing it now, Christo, they react to it in very different ways. And the most depressing thing, because this is going to keep happening in our society when we face these, you know, calamities that bring a new sense of distrust in our institutions, the conservative response has been generally, and we saw this, I think it was today even, wasn't it, Christo, tweeted out from Aaron O'Toole himself.
That really poorly written. Yeah.
It's just, I'm trying to go through it now, and it's like one of those things that it's supposed to mean something else that I just don't understand. Do you got it here?
Yeah, yeah. So Aaron O'Toole tweeted out, you know, about 12 hours ago now when we're recording. So basically on the Monday we record, he says, Canada's conservatives want to see an end to lockdowns, restrictions to your liberty, and the ongoing impact of mental wellness on our society. So basically what he's trying to write there is, we want to see an end to lockdowns. We want to be the party of liberty, and we want to deal with the mental health crisis, which is basically code word for, we want to cram your kids back into school.
Yeah.
And so, even though, whereas early childcare cases are quite low, that is not the case in K-12 schools, mm-hmm. where they are one of the leading cases of or the leading sources of new cases in much of Canada. But yeah, the way it's written is that they want to end lockdowns, but then also restrict your liberty. And, you know, also they support to, they also want to restrict the ongoing impact on mental wellness. Very poorly written. But yeah, the conservatives are definitely sort of trying. Erin O'Toole is still trying to have it both ways on COVID. Mm-hmm. He's always tried to have it both ways on COVID. He's never been anti-vax. He's never been anti-mask. He's never really been anti-lockdown in a very strict sense. But he's always tried to, like, play up, like, the individual liberties as a way to sort of say, I'm not Maxime Bernier. We're not the PPC. But, you know, we're also, you know, going to be distinct from the Greens, Liberals, Bloc, NDP, who all have a broadly similar, you know, general support of masks and vaccines and what mm-hmm. have you. Nope. And, yeah. This is a continuing issue, and there's a lot of pressure on O'Toole and a lot of conservative leaders around the country, and we see this in the United States as well, that to be seen as pro science on this is to be seen as a traitor to your party, and that is a growing sentiment, although lesser in Canada than the U.S.
Yeah, and I think the interesting takeaway, and I believe we talked about this last week, is how absolutely ludicrous it is that the conservatives are couching all of this in the very real destruction of one's mental health due to these lockdowns and the destruction of norms, and believing that they actually want change to happen, not just so the economy can continue, but because they really do care about mental health, when no conservative government has a good track record in this fucking country about ensuring that we have resources in place, or liberal government for that matter, ensuring we have resources in place to protect and advocate for mental health in this country. So we're seeing more of that, and it's a little more sickening because everyone who's saying it has, you know, dubious intentions. Like, it's very, very clear that if this was really something about improving the mental health of Canadians, then why isn't there any mention of this in your platform beforehand? You know, why isn't this something that was important before? Or is that just a very easy scapegoat for something that's so fucking real for so many people to make your bold-faced capitalism just seem a little more palatable? And I don't, what do you think the more liberal response to this change in how the COVID pandemic is occurring here, at least in the province and then maybe outwardly in Canada? Because I do think there is a transition now that we're not just relying on the daily cases to be our one indicator. Now it's a little more nuanced. It's not quite as deadly. The waters have gotten a little muddier, and I think we see the general conservative response pretty clearly. What's your take on the liberal response?
Well, you're seeing this more and more, that there's like a growing desire to put the economy ahead of patients and
people,
people and public health, right? And you're seeing this in the U.S. as well, where more and more Democratic Party people, like the new mayor of New York, is basically like, we can defeat COVID with swagger, and we got to open up.
No olive oil. Make sure everyone knows. He was very against that.
Yeah. And then, you know, also suggesting in some ways that, you know, we don't want to have too much testing again, sort of the Doug Ford and Trumpian line. Yeah. Too much testing. In some cases, it's been suggested, including by people, you know, not in strictly in the conservative camp, that, you know, if people are on their way back to work, maybe you don't test them, because if they're asymptomatic and they can maybe go back, but if you test them and they have a positive COVID test and that looks really bad, so it's basically like pretending they don't have COVID. You're seeing in Canada a gradual move towards, you know, away from testing. And I think that's a mixture of necessity, but also just the politics of it. Mm-hmm. You just pretend it doesn't exist. And look, the BCNDP to some degree has done this as well. So I just think in reality, there's a practical challenge that Omicron is very different. In some ways, it's worse. In some ways, it's less worse. But it's challenged certain things like workplace attendance. If a lot of people are getting COVID, even if it's mild, that can knock out your workforce. And you're seeing a growing admission from a lot of these people that this is really about the economy more than society, and more than the health of communities and of individuals. And so I do see that as a growing trend. Mm-hmm. And that it's difficult for liberals, to do that, because unlike conservatives, where there's a natural constituency against the lockdowns, against the mandates, etc., you know, for so long, there's been broad support among people who identify as liberals or Democrats or what have you for a lot of these things. And now the narrative is very quickly switching to, well, actually, you don't need to lock down for as long. Maybe even having COVID and going out in some cases is okay, you know, et cetera. And, you know, this is going to become an issue. And I think you're going to see this continue to affect things. When it comes to tensions with workers as well, you're seeing that where elements of the Democratic Party in the United States is attacking teachers unions in particular, mm-hmm. because teachers unions have the gall to say, we don't want our members to die. And, you know, this is, schools are not providing productive education right now in person in many cases anyway. And you're seeing some elements say, actually, we have to basically tell the teachers unions to fuck off. Not Republicans, but Democrats. And you're going to see that trend as well. When push comes to shove, liberals will back capital over workers. You know, when it's easy, they'll throw a bone to workers. But, you know, here the lines are being drawn, and it looks like the people that drive the economy are ready to just sort of, you know, say fuck you to workers and fuck you to people that can't get vaccinated and are put at risk by a reckless COVID policy. And of course, we know that it's short-sighted. I understand the impact on the economy and on individual workplaces, but I mean, the whole reason we have Omicron largely is because not enough people got vaccinated in the developed world. Mm-hmm. We didn't sufficiently lock down. And crucially, we hoarded vaccines because, you know, three or four companies, you know, told us all to, and we were like, okay, sir.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of then, funny like, to look at like any of the positives, and maybe there is even a ton that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation may have done for this world, might have been completely negated by his
even
advocacy.
Even if you are a fan of Bill and Melinda Gates, right? You know, Epstein associate Bill Gates.
Yes.
And even if you are, and I'm guessing in our audience that's
not
a minority,
like
objectively he was, you know, he played a crucial role in sort of insisting that the vaccines not be made, you know, patent free, like that, like some of these companies may in some cases have done it, but Bill Gates played a role in kind of going to these as a very influential man in so many ways, obviously, and basically convincing them to stand up for the voiceless property. You know, people have voices, but property can't speak for itself.
Yeah, and they'll do it wrong, too. I remember that was an interesting narrative that was being pushed by Gates, that, you know, a lot of these growing countries just don't have the capability of creating these vaccines if they did get the patents, and it would cause like an even more mutant strain. Like, it's just, it's so sickening to hear now. And see now, like, the effects of these sort of choices. And it's not as if that's changed. Like, to the best of my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are still great limitations on vaccine patents on different places in the developing world.
Yeah.
I think so, right?
There's not been any meaningful effort, really, to challenge patent. There's been isolated calls, but fundamentally, you know, private property still controls the vaccine.
Yeah.
You know, some developing countries have worked on vaccines. Cuba has, it often does, despite, you know, all the pressure put on Cuba by the United States, has, I believe, developed their own kind of vaccine. But in general, the mass productive capacity comes from, you know, the Pfizers and Modernas and AstraZenecas and blah, blah, blah. And, other countries have basically said, you know, we have facilities in India and South Africa and Russia, in a lot of developing or, you know, sort of, you know, developed countries on the poor end of the scale, And we will develop this, and we can maybe do it cheaper, or we can help, you know, just increase the capacity, which would lower costs at least marginally. And these companies have said no. And that is one of the reasons we have Omicron, right? Mm-hmm. Like mutations were bound to happen. I don't want to suggest that if we just would have played this a little bit better, we would have automatically, you know, had no Delta wouldn't have happened or anything. But one of the reasons COVID is mutating so quickly and so differently time to time is that, you know, we haven't done a good job of containing it. Either we haven't done enough social distancing or masking or vaccinating. And I think crucially, the vaccination thing is mostly a story of a failing on a global scale with vaccine equity. Because in Canada, like you know, anti-vaxxers in Canada and in other developed countries have played a role in that. But the biggest factor is that there are entire nations where basically almost no one can get vaccinated, even if they wanted to.
Yeah,
right? And that's just fucking inequality.
Yeah, it's just blatant inequality that even if you are a terrible person that doesn't care about the lives of people in countries that you can't know the names of, you still need to understand like just the very basics about virology and how this sort of stuff works. Like it will be worse for you and the people you love, even if you're healthy, even if you have access to the best, you know, medical services that money could buy, like preferred treatment, you still have to suffer from these lockdowns to protect other people. And I think one of the most sickening things about this entire endeavor is that we've seen what conservatives are doing. They have a bit of the anti-lockdown sentiment already behind them, so they can jump on the mental health and economy bandwagon. As you said, it's a little harder for the liberals because, you know, there was such a great distinction for so much of this pandemic. You know, you're anti-vax or maybe you're conservative.
At least in rhetoric,
at least in rhetoric. Right? Yeah, absolutely. And
just like what the basis of the party support, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's easier to be a conservative and, you know, in Canada, going anti-vax isn't going to work, all of that. You know, there's broad support for the vaccine, except for among the PPC, even conservative members. But if you're saying, oh, we know we have to start easing back into normal, we got to start gradually reducing the lockdowns, you'll get pushback as a liberal from your base, but probably not as a conservative.
Yeah. And I think that interesting transition that's happening, I'm wondering how, you know, dye-in-the-wool liberals are going to respond to this sort of change, and if there will be the always present unification of conservatism and liberalism here in Canada with one powerful force that, you know, ultimately makes sure that the poorest people suffer the most. But the question I have now, when the issues of the pandemic are a little bit murkier, it's not as clear as, you know, there's 7,000 cases each day, so therefore no one can leave their home. Even scientifically, there's not a real consensus about what that means for how each individual should live. What, in your estimation, has been, and I'm trying to find it myself here, the NDP's platform or at least response to this change, or if not that, maybe the more leftist perspective, as we try to bring here, on the pandemic at this point? Because I don't think it's cut and dry.
No, I mean, like, look, the NDP, I think, again, with BC, their position isn't meaningfully different enough. It's not the worst in Canada, but and maybe it is the best in some ways, but the BC has the kind of thing where they're sort of discouraging testing, I think, through a mixture of triaging and also because, you know, they know that the more you test, the more you're going to find and the worse you look, right? Like, it's the Donald Trump, Doug Ford, you know,
playbook,
nexus,
yeah.
Right? I mean, one thing from the left, I think, is that there is a tension right now. This is sort of playing out, I think, among not necessarily the NDP as a party, but among the base of left people, people within the NDP and maybe people to the left of the NDP, is that 99% of those people, maybe more, honestly, support vaccination.
Yes, absolutely.
And support social distancing and all of those sorts of things. There's not that kind of like, you know, that sometimes you get to see overrepresented online being like the anti-vax leftist. They are a negligible part of this discussion, but there's a growing tension, I think, on the question of moralism here. Right. And I think I find myself somewhere in the middle on it. Because on the one hand, you have a lot of people on the left who sort of like some liberals, and I don't mean to offend, because I fall into this at least partially, are making this about a kind of moral imperative and an issue of individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And though things exist, they do. We all have individual responsibilities here. To our ability, we shouldn't try to go out if we don't need to. We shouldn't be having massive parties. We should wear masks when we can, especially indoors. We should have get vaccinated. And, you know, if you've been able to, I have get the booster. Do all of the things you can do to protect yourselves and others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do those things, some on the left are suggesting that we need to ostracize those people. We need to criticize those people. We need to shame those people, right? We need to do that to some degree. Others suggest that the way we've approached it has been, one, counterproductive, or at least ineffective, but critically, this over-reliance on individual responsibility has sort of given a pass to governments, to health authorities, and the biggest one probably to employers, right? Mm-hmm. To employers. That we've made it all about the house parties and the people that maybe don't wear the masks when they should, and the people that don't get vaccinated
or
when
new
they should.
Immigrants that don't understand, yeah. As the Doug Ford playbook from
last year.
Yeah,
well, let's
year.
Leave out the right-wing arguments,
okay,
right?
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is on the left, right? Where, you know, it's, you know, all of this, and we blame these types, and we've done it too. We've spent a lot of time talking about the PPC crazies and all mm-hmm. of that. And some suggest that, well, maybe if that stuff, it's not that any of that is wrong, but it's just that if you make it about the culture war and the vaccine as the culture war, the mask as the culture war, the social distancing as the culture war, then Amazon and all these people get off the hook because you're not talking about what the real big issue here is, which is that we have a system that doesn't care whether a lot of people ultimately live or die, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't preclude us from suggesting people get vaccinated. And I honestly, I'm a supporter of a total vax mandate. I really am. Mm-hmm. I really am. I don't know if like the left is not in full agreement on that. I think you should be able to mandate people get vaccinated. I really do. I don't mm-hmm. know the, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how you implement it, but I would support a total societal vaccine mandate. I really would. But insofar as people have the choice, the number one enemy isn't necessarily the individual anti-vaxxer, especially if they're just some guy or gal without a platform, right? We're not talking yeah. about, you know, somebody with 100,000 followers on Twitter that's spreading bullshit and killing people, right? With their mm-hmm. spreading of bullshit, right? And those people, honestly, are terrible. And I think we should shame those people. And if that's part of the culture war, so be it. But I definitely think that's a growing debate on the left. How do we acknowledge that as individuals, we have a role to play here? In some ways, more than usual. Because I know on the left, we want to eschew the individual. We want to de-emphasize, oh, separating your plastics from your papers because it doesn't fucking matter because 10 companies or 100 companies yeah. are polluting the earth. And in some ways, emphasizing recycling, even partially, may be counterproductive to
yeah,
actually addressing.
I still do that.
Know.
Like there is that
yeah,
thing.
No, 100%.
Like, that understanding is, it, 100%. And that's an interesting distinction, right? To
yeah.
recognize perhaps some of the futility of individual responsibilities, yeah. but then yeah. also deciding to exercise some of those individual responsibilities.
And I think with COVID, it's one of those situations where more than a lot of those other things, more than simply riding your bike one extra day a week or doing those sorts of things, COVID actually is a place where the individual can probably have more impact. So I do see the need there. But this is the growing debate on the left is how do you both encourage positive personal action, which is important if you're building socialist communities and what have you. You want to build a socialist society. Individuals matter still. We're not, you know, socialism does not erase the individual, right?
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that you also have to look at the system. And that is a growing debate. And I think in the NDP, you see people divided on that. You have maybe you have some people that are really invested in the moral imperative of the vaccine, and sometimes that loses allows focus to be lost on the broader issue. You blame the individual vaccine failures, and they deserve some blame, but you're not focusing as much on the systems in place.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting to understand that when you do take the position of recognizing that the systemic damage that has been done to our social services is leading to the deaths that we're occurring today. And it's something, you know, we could have dealt with beforehand. If that is the position you have, it almost feels like in the current narrative, that position is disregarded a little bit because it's not as prescient about what's going on. It's almost seen as like, you know, that's not what we can deal with now. Maybe it's about these anti-vaxxers. Maybe it's about these lockdowns. There's a certain momentum with the discourse. When I think, you know, personally, and I think this is not an uncommon thought, that the most popular and the most successful anti-vaxxer pundit didn't even do 1/10 of the damage to Ontarians that Doug Ford and liberalism and conservatism has done on provincial governments here over the past 10 to 15 years of completely gutting these services that we need to ensure that just generally people can survive when we're not facing a pandemic. So like, I think that's very clear, but I think that position and that narrative will have a hard time finding purchase right now because we're so stuck in it, and people need an active villain in some ways. They need someone who they can combat against. But I really think that the NDP would gain a lot of support from, you know, this base that is a little divided if they were able to more effectively have positions like that. Andrew Horvath, to her credit, you know, when Doug Ford first announced this whole rigmarole fuck up last show about the later lockdown, when maybe this should have been 2 weeks before, she made it pretty clear that these issues that we're facing now have a lot to do with Doug Ford's reign here in Ontario. Yeah. And a lot of these deaths have direct connection to that. But
it's very challenging, right? Yeah. Because, again, you have to be careful. And this is one of the reasons I think why I took a few minutes to sort of answer that. Because if you sort of... it's very easy to be painted as anti-vaxxer or anti-mask if you sort of try to say, hey, look, maybe it's not always the priority to only talk about only the anti-vaxxers. Yeah. And maybe we should say that, anti-vaxxers are a problem. And again, I support a full mask. I support mandates. I support a vaccine mandate. I really do. But, COVID is hitting us especially hard, not necessarily because of the individual delinquents, for lack of a better term, that a lot of people would call them, but again, because of these broad decisions, including which, this is breaking news, schools are going to open again in Ontario on January 17th. That was announced.
Well, there you go. Well, thank God you had those 2 weeks, right? Like,
they couldn't
have done that before. They
not even 2 weeks, right? Wasn't it 1 week?
I believe it was
Wasn't it like a week and a half? Yeah, so schools are opening up on the 17th, I think. Basically, people got an extra week, maybe 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I don't know what they did in those 2 weeks. I don't know if they have schools have all been retrofitted for the state-of-the-art ventilation and what have you. There hasn't necessarily been a sharp decline in Omicron or COVID generally. Hospitals are still very heavy, are very full. So I don't know. I don't know why now. I don't know.
It is strange. It does seem like, and we know this from, you know, a lot of the reporting, I think specifically by the Toronto Star last year, that a lot of the choices here in Ontario made by Doug Ford were seemingly directly influenced by the different lobbyists that he would meet the night before. And the big choice came out the next day. So maybe this is just, you know, some political machinations. You know, we said that when Ford initially decided to have this version of a lockdown that we have now, it seemed to be something that his government did not want to do, but was told basically that he had to by experts, that he could get hundreds of thousands of cases a day and thousands more people in the ICU if there wasn't something like that. What has possibly happened in 8 days that has changed the arithmetic of that? The only thing I can think of, and this is wild speculation, but what else am I going to do here on Left Turn Canada, that the political downside of the possibility of thousands more people in the hospital isn't as much of a downside as people upset about the current lockdown. Like, I really do feel like this latest choice is one of political prudence, maybe not of, you know, the healthiest decision.
Oh, yeah. All of this is politics. Like, again, a tweet here, and this is from Robin Urbach, who is not, you know, she, if anything, I think sometimes they err on the side of, like, you know, going easy on COVID.
Oh, yeah.
But they make a good point here where, the you know, in response to the breaking news that the schools are going to open, they say the fact that the government can decide schools will reopen within a week still to go, with a week still to go, when, by most metrics, things are still getting worse, seems to suggest they never believed there was a health-related point to closing the schools in the first place. Yeah. So you're right, it's a political calculation. Oh, Doug Ford waited to close the schools because he did not want to do it because of the economic impacts and the narrative that if you're closing the schools, things are bad, and if things are bad, I'm doing a bad job. And so he closed the schools, didn't want to do it, though, so he likely thought to himself, what's the minimum amount of time I can close the schools to make it look like I'm being, you know, I'm charting the right balance between caution and, you know, reopening and whatnot. And I think that's clearly it's a political decision, because if you closed because you believed it was dangerous a couple weeks ago now, then there's no reason to open now.
Yeah,
there's
nothing has happened. Nothing
there's
has
no
changed.
Material change. There's no material change. There's none. And so it's very clearly he's caught himself out on saying it's just clearly for politics.
Yeah.
It's clearly for politics. Either he thinks that now he struck the balance and his base won't be mad at him, you know, or, you know, he's getting calls from the Chamber of Commerce or from other groups. And basically he said, OK, now it's time to reopen. I've closed for a week or week and a half, whatever it was. And like now it's time to reopen. Yeah.
And it's not like this is a risky
and no tests,
political decision
right?
for
this,
him.
Right?
Either like that's the thing we realize we haven't had the, you know, polling since, but a lot of the numbers we've seen beforehand and reported on the show indicate that he would win pretty swiftly despite these flip-flopping choices.
We've noted that, like, he's in a good position, but of course there may well be a coalescence of the anti-conservative vote and all of these things. But no, I do think that he is worried about losing some of his base, which is one of the reasons he made that decision. You know,
there you go.
Not all conservative. Don't forget, you know, the Liberals as recently as 2014 in Ontario won a majority government with basically, you know, a significant portion of the vote. It's likely the case that he had to get at least some Liberals to vote for him to win. And doesn't want to lose those types of people. And so he had to really try to strike that balance. And I think that's what he's trying to do. Maybe he's done it successfully. But what this is not about is the science around COVID. Again, there's not going to be testing in schools.
So we won't even know how badly he's fucked up. Like, it's probably almost not. Fascinating.
You might get a facsimile based on absences.
Yeah.
Like kids that are out, teachers that are out. Those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're not going to have a definitive case. Man. Because most of the cases as it is, you know, are not going to be hospitalization serious. You know, it could still be quite serious.
Yeah.
And we're not going to know. We're not.
There's one other thing, Christo, I wanted to run by you. I saw, you know, it was actually trending today a little bit on Twitter, and I'm wondering what your take on it is. There's a concern now, a growing concern from segments and perhaps the more radical of the right wing here in Canada, that Trudeau now in the coming days could enact the Emergencies Act here in Canada and essentially become, you know, pure authoritarian, pure God Emperor, and that it's going to happen finally. Not that, you know, he could have used it beforehand when we had different services in place where that maybe, you know, he would have used the Emergencies Act. What exactly is the Emergencies Act? And do people who are this batshit crazy really have to fear that Trudeau is going to do it or that he'll become God Emperor if he does?
Well, Canada has an Emergencies Act, which allows, in certain cases, the federal government to sort of overstep traditional constitutional jurisdictional boundaries, right? Whether it's in a time of war or other crises, there have been times, whether it's under the Emergency Act or some acts that have kind of covered similar things, the government has been able to to effectively say, at least for the time being, we are going to sort of override provincial authority. You saw it in World War II, for instance, with most things. But, you know, for example, labor law became fully federalized, essentially, right? Like the federal labor law applied in many cases, not just to, you know, federally regulated industries like banking and federal employees and all that, but applied to the industrial sector as well, under the argument that in a time of war where we have to manage a national economy for war and feeding our soldiers and feeding the people still here, you can't just have it be the provincial government. Pierre Trudeau actually was able to get a temporary imposition on provincial labor law by forcing wage cap on all unionized workers in Canada, in effect, and all medium to large employers, even if they were regulated provincially, and even against the desires in some cases of provincial governments, because he was able to argue that inflation in the mid-1970s constituted a national crisis. And so if inflation could be a national crisis, I do think there is at least an argument that Justin Trudeau could make, which is that COVID is an exception. It is a pandemic that is global and national in nature. Issues that are national and global often default to the federal government. And while we understand that typically healthcare is a provincial matter, this is an exceptional circumstance. And so we need to use the Emergencies Act to maybe pass federal guidelines to mandate certain cooperation between the provinces to any of these things. But Trudeau will never do that. Trudeau won't do that.
Yeah,
there's a couple of reasons. One, it's politically,
like that's
it's politically
now.
Deadly, right? Like if Trudeau did that in Quebec in particular, where the fairly or not, the current government in Quebec is extremely popular and they are going to just romp to a victory unless something crazy happens in the next election, which is this year as well, I believe. But I believe it is at some point this year. The reality is if Trudeau did that, it would be with major political ramifications. Quebec and many other places would be furious at him for using the Emergencies Act, even attempting to use it, whether it held up in court or what have you, right? And I think critically, more than that, because Justin Trudeau is not a principled man that you just can't do what he wants to do, is that he's in a pretty sweet spot right now. Justin Trudeau really isn't getting a lot of heat. Justin Trudeau can get a lot of benefits with the CERB and all of that and being seen as this national leader. And you get to play some role in COVID with the procurement of vaccines and PPE and look like you're delivering for the people. But ultimately, and I think the trickier part, is the actual implementation of everything from the vaccines to the distribution to the actual treatment and testing of people and all of that. And provincial governments have by and large struggled and they've been more likely to be criticized. And Justin Trudeau thinks to himself, well, look, I can look like I'm the good guy, not necessarily be seen as a COVID villain, even if I'm not always seen as doing a great job. And if I was to pass the Emergencies Act, all of a sudden, I'm responsible, right? So we know that Justin Trudeau, to some degree, can't just, you know, tisk the conservative premiers, and while he doesn't use the powers potentially available to him, he knows that if he doesn't use the Emergencies Act, he can sort of say on the one hand that, oh, there's, you know, provinces are failing and they need to trust the science. He can therefore then go to people and say, well, look, elections have consequences. You elected the Doug Ford government. The Constitution is the Constitution. I can do everything I can, but ultimately it's up to the Ontario government.
It's not my jurisdiction, man. Not my jurisdiction.
Out of my jurisdiction. Right. And that is true. It is. To a large degree, healthcare is, especially in the operation of it day to day, it's undeniably provincial. It's undeniably. The Canada Health Act makes broader healthcare questions more bi-jurisdictional than liberals will admit because they're fucking liars, especially certain types on Twitter. But like, look, undeniably day-to-day operation of healthcare is provincial. 100%, right? 100%. But, you know, the Emergencies Act could have been used in some cases to, for example, have national vaccination centers and have national policies help to better control workplace health and safety. If provincial governments were failing to protect workers and students and the vulnerable, more than just, you know, accepting voluntary requests to have the military sent in, which I suppose is a federal imposition, right? You know, you know, you could actually use that by force. But Trudeau would never do it. One, I do think it would hurt him politically because it would likely push many people to the bloc in Quebec. But I don't think he wants it. Right now, Justin Trudeau is not getting blamed. And if you look at federal polling, I mean, if anything, since the last election, if you look at federal polling, there hasn't been a ton of movement, but he's not down, right? Like the most recent federal polling, with the new, the polling, the 338 model has the Liberals down 7 seats. The Conservatives down 3, the NDP plus 12, because of course, strategic voting screws the NDP. The Bloc 2 down 2, and the Greens static at 2. So are the Liberals down? Yeah, I suppose they're down most of all, but again, nothing changes. Fundamentally, they still got like a 30, almost 40 seat lead on the Conservatives. They're clearly in the governing seat, the driver's seat. And if you look at like polling, for the most part, they've been doing quite well.
Yeah.
They're at least average. Like the most recent poll I think I've seen, actually a good one for the NDP, was an ECOS poll that was done in December, and it had the Liberals at 32 minus 1, the Conservatives minus 9 down to 25, the NDP plus 5 at the 23, the PPC plus 5 to 10, the Bloc down 4. Down 4 from 8, so they're down half. The Greens plus 2. So again, if you're looking at the polling, the Justin Trudeau has not been punished. He's not been rewarded, but he's not been punished. And I think that if he used the National Emergencies Act, he would get punished. Like the polling averages as we started the year were the Liberals, you know, up a couple, the Conservatives down a couple. 34 for the Liberals, 30 for the Conservatives. He's in his perfect spot.
Like that's the thing that perhaps this entire fear, this sentiment, the Conservatives that want Trudeau to be this villain in a way that they believe he is almost humorous, because he's actually a villain in the way that you would like, that you would respond with, that he wouldn't do anything that he actually believes in. Because I would say that perhaps he doesn't believe in that much. Like we've seen the promises that Trudeau has made and not needing to follow through. So why would he do anything risky to maybe do something that could help people, that would impose on civil liberties in a way that would be a big problem for his constituents? There's no reality where that would happen. He's just not the sort of leader that would do that. So it's fascinating to see people afraid of it. And I think this is actually a pretty good segue into, you know, the conservative or perhaps neoliberal mind of Canadians. We have an op-ed in the National Post, again, this national newspaper that is very, very conservative, I think you can say pretty clearly, but is also a national newspaper that's read by maybe even hundreds of people, who knows, with the death of media. But Jordan Peterson has an op-ed titled "Open the Damn Country Back Up Before Canadians Wreck Something We Can't Fix." So I know we don't normally do this, but I went through it today, and it is a fascinating look into one of the most popular Canadian quote-unquote intellectuals. Christo, for those that are maybe not aware, that don't know the name Jordan Peterson, you know, how would you describe him to people that that don't know his oeuvre?
He's fucking terrible, man. He's the fucking worst.
Because you come from academia too, so that I thought you'd have an interesting perspective.
Like, he's a professor, I believe. I still think he works at U of T, but he was like a U of T professor. From what I've heard, like some of his academic work wasn't like bad necessarily. Like, you know, he's not a quack in terms of the, you know, the fact that he became a professor. But a few years ago, he sort of rose to prominence basically because he was infuriated because some trans and non-binary people wanted to maybe have different pronouns, either neo pronouns, you know, like not he, not him, or what have you, or to, you know, a trans person that would prefer to be called they or them, or a person that is biologically female but identifies as male and they want to be called him or what have you. And, you know, he freaked out about that. And he's also seen as sort of a whisperer to, like, incels and, like, young, angry men. Some of the advice is fairly benign, basically, like, clean your room. Like, that's literally one of his things. Like, if you want to have, like, a good organized life, you have to organize your space and be clean and all of that. But then it sort of morphs into this idea that feminism is the reason why men are angry, and women are, women's sexual freedom has destroyed society because now women are freed from monogamy.
And the Little Mermaid is very evil. We need to examine all the Disney movies, which was an interesting take.
And so, and like, he's got some general right wing takes. And so, of course, to some degree, I don't know if you classify him as an anti-vaxxer necessarily, but he's definitely bought into, like, a lot of the right-wing COVID narratives, 100%.
Yes. He is a very big, and since that time, I think, he
also
became
a former NDP supporter back when he was a very young man.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, but he also became a real figurehead for right-wing movements across America as well. And
he's world famous. Yeah. He is one of the most famous, again, quote-unquote, intellectuals on the right. Undeniably. Undeniably. His impact in the last few years has been massive, mostly beyond his traditional academic expertise, of course.
And that shows here, because if you go through this article, Christo, it literally sounds like some fat dude that's really upset, and I speak for fat people as well, that their order was mistook at a restaurant. Like, it is absolutely insane that this story was published, because it is the most insane muling I think I've ever read, and I've had to read a lot of these over my years. But the only other thing I want to add about Jordan Peterson that was, you know, kind of unfortunate, but perhaps a cruel irony, that he spent most of his, you know, professional life trying to moralize and explain the more righteous authoritarian way to live, and then he became and released information about his, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction, and was sent to, like, a terrible hospital in Eastern Europe by his crazy daughter. Like, it's just, he is a very interesting individual.
We can't go in. They lived on, like, a purely carnivorous diet.
Oh, I forgot,
like,
about that. Yeah.
Not just the, you know, just they only, I think they literally only ate, like, beef, I believe. I don't know. I'm not an expert, but it's like, they didn't eat vegetables. They didn't eat bread. They didn't eat, anything else but meat.
Yeah.
Not typical people. You would say him anyway.
But famous, very, very famous. So honestly, for the National Post, like, right now, most of their stories might have a couple dozen, maybe 50 comments. This has over 2,000.
Yeah. And he's world famous. Yeah. He goes beyond Canada. Mm-hmm. He's undeniably influential. So in general, he takes a lot of these. He's generally a right wing guy. And so if you look at most issues and think, what's the wrong position? Jordan Peterson will have it.
He's got it. And he also talks like this, which is also really important.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this article, and I kid you not, Christo, the first, I would say, 6 or 7 paragraphs, at least half of it, is a very, very detailed retelling of him trying to talk on the phone to his bank, to his airline, to a different restaurant, and how difficult it was because of what's happening in COVID, and how personally upset that he is that he can't fly to Alberta like he does every year. And then when he finally did get there, even though there was all of these issues, they didn't have all the foods in his fancy, treat place that he really likes to go to. It is half of this article. And it's just, again, it kind of spits in the face of this whole mystique that I think he has kind of become the figurehead of this macho masculinism that is about self-reliance. But when you actually read the words he says, it's just all about how pathetic he really is. Like, it's really, really embarrassing. So I don't know if that is something that people who follow him don't really care about or think is cool, but it is absolutely shocking when he does actually start to talk about, you know, the systems in place and his real thoughts. Here is one excerpt I wanted to go through. The systems are now shaking. We're compromising them seriously with this unending and unpredictable stream of restrictions, lockdowns, regulations, and curfews. We're also undermining our entire monetary system with the provision of unending legress from government coffers to ease the stress of COVID response. We're playing with fire. We're demolishing. We've already demolished two Christmas seasons in a row. Life is short, and these are rare occasions. So I just, for these words to come from this man, I just feel a unique revulsion that we don't always get here, that he can't seem to recognize that maybe the systems are broken, not because you can't easily go to Alberta and like go to your favorite treat place, but because of the systems that you believe in more strongly than perhaps humanism or any other form of compassion, of like pure capitalism, are destroying this country. And the idea that he's afraid of this authoritarian response, I don't know, man. Like, it's just, it really, because I'm not as much of a follower of his.
This is the guy, he'll say, and maybe we'll move on from this, because this is not the Jordan B. But, like, he won't say he supports this, but this guy has mused about, like, forcing women into, like, relationships.
Yes.
Like, forcing women, like, society, and he'll say, oh, I don't necessarily support this. I'm just, you know, I'm an academic, so I'm just big thinking that, like, oh, you know what we need to do to solve violent men is every man gets a state-mandated wife, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like going back to, and so it's like, yeah, so this is small government Andy here, right? Like, this is small government Jordan Peterson with his fucking state-mandated wives. And it's like, all of this is such bullshit because all of these people would like, they love totalitarianism when it serves them. They love rigid social structures when it serves them. So like Jordan Peterson can go fuck himself.
Absolutely. But I just like the one sentiment that does scare me is how he is able to find purchase now as the pandemic narrative is shifting. Because I don't think this article would have been as successful if it was presented a year ago.
Yeah. I think so. Jordan Peterson's his audience is what it is. Now, one thing is with the National Post, which again is a right wing source, but not necessarily like far right. Would they have published it earlier? Maybe not. But Jordan Peterson would have wrote this and would have gotten major play because that's who he is. He is truly he's a massive figure. He brings his own narrative. I think. Would have happened regardless. But you are right in saying that maybe certain sources are getting, like, again, even you know, you could see it in Canada and in the States where more quote unquote moderate to liberal sources are publishing op-eds that are, you know, saying, oh, it's time to reopen. Right. And that is a change
for these really like emotional, weepy kind of faux totalitarianism ways, too. Like, that's the thing that I find interesting, that this is now being co-opted by this individual that is such an anomaly and others like him that represent the real hypocrisy of this worldview. But it's finding purchase now because the pandemic is becoming a little bit muddier. And I think we've talked about it here enough, Christo, but the real damage of what's happening in this pandemic and the real crisis isn't the fact that there is a percentage of the population that isn't vaccinated. That is an issue, absolutely. But I think it's safe to say there is a deeper crisis about how our government, provincially and federally, has decided to maintain certain services and disregard others. And we're paying for it now. And there's no real indication that this is going to change. You know, we're not seeing anyone say, as soon as this is done, we need to ensure that there is, I misspoke there. There is some NDP's push in that way, but that we need huge spending. There needs to be a big change because this is going to happen again. We need to reinforce the social safety nets that has been gutted. I haven't really heard that perhaps as loudly as I thought at this moment in time? You know, do you think we'll even see that, or is it constantly just going to be let's put out more fires and never look at what the actual issue is? It's just individual responsibilities. You know, everyone has their bad, their bugbear, whether it's the conservatives that believe it's the lazy immigrants, the liberals that perhaps will blame people that are just a little poorer than them, but they're the most evil. And then maybe, of course, leftists that see conservatives who are like that, who are left, who are, you know, anti-vax. So I'm wondering for the future. And I like to, as we close out the show here, kind of leave you to look at some portends here about what you think will happen in the next coming weeks and months.
Yeah. Nothing big's going to change. This COVID, no. Like, look, no, there's no way. There's no way. It would have already started, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, no, very clearly what's happened is it's moving crisis to crisis. There's not going to be significant investment in healthcare. There's not going to be a nationalization of Connaught Labs again or something like that, so Canada can domestically produce and research its vaccines and do all of those sorts of things, produce its own PPE. No, it's just not going to happen. Yeah. It's not going to happen. There's not going to be significant improvements in labor standards necessarily, maybe some minor things. But very clearly, like, there's this idea that, you know, we just got to get back to normal, even though normal is helped cause COVID, right? Like, COVID might have happened regardless, but the reason it hit the way it did and was so devastating and so unequal, like, everyone was affected, right? But like, so unequally devastating to so many people was because of the normal that existed.
Yeah.
So I don't see it changing. Like, I don't, like.
Yeah. No, I think we're
going back to the status quo, more or less. Now, you know, culturally, there might be a greater awareness. Culturally, you might see, like in many East Asian countries, people wear masks when they just don't feel very well.
Mm-hmm.
You might see some of these small cultural changes, not small necessarily, but noticeable individual changes. And maybe this is sort of a counterpoint to what we talked about earlier, which is that if there will be changes, it might come less at the policy end and more how individuals behave. And that might have positive and negative effects. But, you know, I don't see the changes needed.
Yeah,
like, I think, for instance, like, one of the things we talked about is, or one of the things that led to that early COVID tragedy was, one, we didn't know what we were doing, but yeah. Healthcare workers, especially long-term care workers, are often very underpaid, precarious, and they lack the ability to get full-time hours at one workplace. Mm. And so in addition to not understanding fully how COVID worked, not necessarily getting at the very beginning how vulnerable the elderly and the sick were, we had all these people getting COVID, these workers, and through, you know, just going, at, but because of the system, not just getting people sick at one home, but working at two or three homes in their community.
Yeah.
And so one of the arguments should be that, well, we need to guarantee basic standards of work for some of these workers. And I don't necessarily seeing that happening long term. I don't necessarily think we're going to see all of the things we need. I mean, like, the even before COVID was over, the companies were already canceling their fucking COVID hero pay.
Yeah.
COVID's still going on.
You've had enough. And you're like, not a hero anymore.
You know, like, the temporary wage surpluses that some companies had.
Yeah.
Like, that shit's gone for the most part. And COVID isn't gone. Right?
No.
So if they can't even keep the positive responses we had during COVID, while COVID is still going on, there's definitely not going to continue after. It's definitely not going to continue.
Well, there you go. I think we'll absolutely keep watching it. Next week, we'll try and steer off COVID as much as we can, because I feel like we've been ringing it out.
There was a really shitty tweet from an Alberta NDP.
Oh, we got something to close it out?
No, but I will. We're running long. But
okay.
If that's still relevant, yeah, just an awful, awful tweet. I just can't stop thinking about how awful it was. Maybe we'll talk about that next week.
Yes, we'll make sure to keep that in the tank. Thank you all for listening. And if you got a little extra money on your hands, which after what we said today, probably chances aren't. But if you got a buck, you can join our little Discord community, patreon.com/lefturncanada. And there's some great people there. Got a lot of questions from them. And next week, we'll make sure to jump on that. And yeah, stay safe, stay healthy. And hopefully by this time next week, the world hasn't come to an end.